Yay, nay.
Did some crick come up with?
Just push in this white area and
yeah, we did.
Get somewhere in there.
That's government.
Y'all ready to get started?
Anytime you want.
This is the same voting system they use in Northern Florida, right?
It is the same voting system, it's just we're gonna, yeah.
Okay.
It's our same.
But then there'll be 20 of us up here, aren't there?
Well, you hit I and confirm that you're ready to get started.
Yeah.
I and a bunch of us.
At this time, I'd like to call to order the Planning Zoning Commission meeting of November 12th, 2018. The time is now 5:07. At this time, anybody will be allowed to speak up on any matter other than personal matters or matters under litigation for a length of time not to exceed 3 minutes. Please state your name and address before you speak. Also, no commission discussion or action may take place on a matter until such matter has been placed on the agenda and posted in accordance with law 3.0. Olson and Olson are going to conduct a commission training. So I'll turn it over to you.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm not sure if this is on. I'm fairly loud, but for the record, you may want it on.
It is now.
Yeah, thank you.
It is now.
I'll stand back here so I don't. Well, thanks for having me. Lauren couldn't make it, but I had planned on teaming him with him on this issue tonight anyways. A little bit about myself, David Olson, a partner at Olson & Olson, third generation there. Lauren and I have been partners for about 10 years. He's a good guy. You're in good hands. Really kind of the point of this little get-together is very informal. I don't want to sit here and just preach. I'd like, if you have questions or examples or things you'd like to address, stop me at any time. We're really going to cover kind of a more of the macro, the 50,000 square foot looking down, and then talk, and then so there's a better understanding of what your role is from that angle, and then we'll talk about the specifics in your two hats, because as y'all well know, you are our planning commission and a zoning commission, so then there's different roles for each one of those entities. So again, we'll talk briefly about the types of cities and their differences, the roles of the branches of government, and where you fit into that picture, because it's really no different from the federal government to the state to you as the local government. You're delegated your authority as a branch of state government anyway. So that's really what governs our rules when it comes to, I guess, your role in the bigger picture of the city as a whole. P&Z rules specifically, again, like I discussed, both your planning hat and your zoning commission hat, talk specifically about what zoning is. You know, this is going to be brief. That's a 3-day seminar in and of itself, is what constitutes zoning and what you can do and what you can't do. It's very, very subjective at times, as y'all well know. Then talk about some other conflicts of interest generally, Public Information Act and the Open Meetings Act, just so you're aware, because they do apply to you individually. So when's the last time y'all actually had any training on your roles as a commission?
For me, 2 years. I don't know about the others.
Well, I've been here.
It's probably about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. Have you all ever had any discussion about general state statutes like Open Meetings Act, Public Information Act, conflicts of interest, and when they're applicable to you?
Yes.
Okay, good. Some of this will be refresher, but you know, it's kind of like going to church. Every now and then it's good to hear it again. And then we can dive into some specifics about issues that you're really dealing with, and now's the time, if you have questions, to talk about them hypothetically so that we don't create a problem with attorney-client privilege. Okay, so let's move on to, of course, now something there. Okay, four types of cities. You, as you well know, you're a home rule city. You have adopted a charter. You had a population that allowed you to go to the voters and say, we'd like you to adopt our charter, which is your constitution. There's three types of general law cities, A, B, and C. Really doesn't matter. It has to do with how many people you had in the town at the time you incorporated. Y'all may know Richmond, Texas, down the road, is one of the last, that and Orchard, that have commission-type general law city. There's a statutory, but they'll have three commissioners. One of those is the acting mayor versus you as a home rule city. I believe you have 5 council members by charter, which is pretty typical. You as a home rule city are granted, you're not granted authority, you're allowed the same authority that the state is through the Constitution, only limited then by how government says you can't do it any further. So limitations are provided by statute, by our legislature, say you can't do A, B, and C, whereas a general law city is only granted authority by statute. That's really the only difference. Again, this is 50,000 feet up in the air talking about government 101, so stop me if you have questions about that. It's really just to set the kind of the mood for what your role is as a PNC. Legislative, city council exclusively, and you know, I'm not going to give Lauren too hard a time since he's not here to defend himself, but this is his PowerPoint, so I'm not sure I would have put necessarily exclusively legislative, because you as a planning commission act in that process. They're not the exclusive legislative body. You offer recommendations when it comes to planning issues, comprehensive plan, zoning districts, things like that that become legislative. You as an advisory board aren't acting in a legislative capacity, but you're assisting in that process. Administrative is more the checks, like the plats, and we'll talk more about that when we get into it. What are you looking at when you look at a plat? What are you allowed to consider when looking at plats versus when you're looking at a zoning change? And there's a big difference between the two. And judicial, obviously, is your municipal court, and your other kind of sister in crime in the zoning ordinance, and that is your zoning board of adjustment. And I think you all understand the difference between you as a zoning commission and the zoning board of adjustment. It's easy to say that as a, you know, giving the 50,000 square foot answer to these differences, but as a practical matter, I assume that y'all have been, I wouldn't say inundated, but you're pretty close to it considering growth is everywhere around here, to dealing with relaxing of the rules or what smells almost like a variance through the zoning amendment process or through any special districts. You'll have a specific use permit process. Do you ever make recommendations on those? Do you ever get people that come in here and say, I'd like to kind of change the zoning ordinance to look more like this? And, you know, where it's a gray area. Where is that bright line rule between you granting somebody relief because they can't meet the strict compliance rules of the zoning ordinance and you acting as a zoning commission and making a recommendation for a zoning change? So it's not always a bright line rule, but that's why you have lawyers. We wouldn't have jobs if it was so bright line. That is my attempt at humor. It's not going to get much better. So. All right, P&Z. Commission created by ordinance. I don't know if any of y'all are into reading the Texas Local Government Code, but I assume you're nodding, so you have. Chapter 211, if you're curious about what your role is as a zoning commission, it outlines kind of strictly in the first couple sections what you do as a zoning commission, what your role is. You are obviously all subject to removal with or without cause by city council. And being a purely advisory committee, it doesn't really create a conflict if council isn't happy with the direction you're going in. And your direction is really the front line. I mean, in the battle of what's being presented as controversial and the citizens having their first say or crack at the apple, you're it. I mean, I assume you get a full house when something controversial comes across your table. And the real value in your role as a commission is to act, is to understand that your purpose, a large part of it, is to receive that input and allow a forum for people to come and express their concerns so that you can tweak or modify the request accordingly before it goes to council. And council doesn't have to listen to all that. It's really kind of, they're passing the buck to you a little bit when it comes to receiving that public input and taking on and deflecting some of those issues, or at least trying to address them, if you can. P&Z acts as an advisor group, we went over to that, regarding zoning change requests, subdivision plats, and changes to the zoning and subdivision ordinances. So you not only approve plats and approve or make recommendations for plats and zoning changes, but you're also, I assume, tasked from time to time to look at provisions of the zoning ordinance or of the subdivision ordinance and suggesting revisions. I don't know if that's something y'all do on a regular basis or not, or just when charged by council or by staff, but it is a role that you play. Okay, some of your responsibilities as a planning and zoning commission. Abide by the regulations and rules as set forth in its bylaws. I don't know when the last time you actually took a look at your bylaws, but I think it's a healthy exercise every 3 to 5 years, just to make sure there isn't something, number one, that violates the law, which I doubt, but two, is archaic in nature, and it happens. Review subdivision plats and present findings to city council. And we'll talk more about your platting hat requirements and what we're looking for from you at the staff level. And I talk as a staff member because I really, as a practical matter, answer to council, and to you guys and gals when you've asked me to come talk to you. But 90% of the time, we're working with staff at the staff level to try to get ahead of some of these issues before we bring them to you. So when it comes to presenting findings, I assume that when it comes to plats, you're relying heavily on your planner and heavily on staff to explain what's going on and what the notes means and the issues presented and what the real issues for you to consider are. And that's just the nature of that beast. I recommend land use changes. We talked briefly about that and making revisions to your land use plan, your comprehensive plan overall, or other things related to subdivision. Continued, review and recommend changes to the subdivision zoning ordinance. That's kind of redundant. I already told you that. Note that the subdivision ordinance does not contain a variance provision. And this is one of those kind of hot topics. I don't know if y'all have ever had to deal with this, but you get some clever surveyors out there and some people that are dealing with differences between maybe your setback requirements and your subdivision and an HOA and what's controlling. And it is unintended sometimes, but you're really not in a position to waiver the rules of your subdivision ordinance through the subdivision plat process. And you're going to rely heavily on staff again to say, okay, here's our checklist of things that we're looking at. We've been through these. They meet all the requirements. At that point, I don't want to say that you're purely acting in an administrative kind of ministerial capacity. However, you're limited legally in how in reasons in which you could deny a plat outside of what's specifically in black and white in our subdivision ordinance. And in those rare circumstances, which you probably will not see, we as part of our job as lawyers will bring it to your attention. It usually has proximity to do with certain public infrastructure, access issues, and those kind of things. But just so y'all are aware, there's very little discretion. So your real job as a planning commission with that hat on is to ensure that it's another layer of checks and balances that before we make a recommendation to approve ultimately a final plat, that we have addressed all the issues that were raised during the preliminary plat process, staff has addressed them, and it meets our current rules and regulations. If you run into one you don't like, the answer is not, hey, let's approve this. I don't agree with that provision of the subdivision regulation. It's then to act in your capacity as a commission, a planning commission, to make a recommendation that council consider looking at that and making revisions. That's the natural progression of government. Now, as you all well know more than most, government is a snail. It moves very slowly, but it's intended to do so because radical change usually tends to be reactionary and not in the greater good of everybody else. So there's a reason why these things take a while. The answer is not to address it in the existing plat, but for future plats. Our zoning ordinance and our subdivision plat, for that matter, are long-term solutions. They're not meant to fix immediate problems. And we'll get into more when we talk about zoning and what that really means. The last point, I talked a little bit about that interface with public through public hearings and open meetings. Really, the whole reason, if you look at the statutory history of a planning commission, it was intended to allow a forum, almost like a town. They were like town hall meetings in the original days, so long before my time. So just if you think of it in that way, and that you are the first line of not just defense, but acceptance and hearing other people's ideas, then I think you get a better understanding of your broad picture as a commission and really what it means to accept public input, take it seriously, instruct staff to take a look at that and come back with recommendations to address issues raised by adjacent land owners or by the developer or whomever it may be. It's your job to juggle that. Plat review. We talked about the first one. I mean, your number one job as a planning commission is to look and make sure that the plat meets all city requirements and state statutes. Talk briefly about the ministerial function. I do think you have some discretion when it comes to certain platting issues. It's one of those deals that you can't make a rule for. And if we run into it, like I said before, an issue like that, and we smell enough heartburn with a proposed plat, consult with your planning department, your city manager, but your legal counsel as well, and there may be ways to address it. But I would look purely, I mean, those are going to be the exception, definitely not the rule. This is just 212. We talked about 211 being the kind of the statutory rules for how to set up a zoning ordinance and the commission. Well, 212 is how you set up the planning commission, its role, and what we can as a city govern when it comes to a subdivision ordinance. So tonight's cool and rainy, so you probably won't have trouble sleeping. But If you have trouble in the days to come, just pick up chapter 212, the Texas Local Government Code, and read a couple pages, and you'll be out like a light. Okay, that's just a technical issue. Zoning, to me, this is where you put on your discretionary hat more so than the platting process. Not to diminish the value in the platting process. It's a wonderful opportunity to catch issues ahead of time before they get to the council level. Not only does the developer invest a lot of time and energy in these things, but having to fix regional issues, drainage, those things can be fleshed out a lot at the zoning commission level or the planning commission level. So it is a vital part of the process, especially with y'all growing as quick as you are. Zoning, the separation of land uses implemented through local legislation that regulates and controls the use and site features of private property. Well, what does that all mean? I mean, essentially that just means that we create zones in our city based on what we think is a responsible development for the overall community. That's the initial look at a zoning ordinance, where things are appropriately developed and what parts of town. You're looking at applicable land uses, whether or not a single-family residential property should be next to an industrial zone, and why you have those buffer zones and commercial and different densities of commercial and different densities of residential, is to create that environment where you don't have a coal plant. I'm exaggerating, obviously, to make the point, right in the middle of a single-family neighborhood, like in my neighborhood in the city of Houston, who decides to live completely rogue, so I have all sorts of things around me that make zero sense. So y'all have a mechanism in place, which is really not as utilized in Southeast Texas as it probably should be. You go to anywhere else in Texas, North Texas, Central Texas, it's hard-pressed to find a city without zoning. You're not the minority, but you are one of the few cities of your size in the area that has taken that on early on in its growth and development, which will make your growth and development a heck of a lot easier, too. So you can regulate land use, lot size, building placement, building height, parking. These are all very objective standards, measurable things. So you're starting to see the zoning ordinance itself does have some interpretation and some subjectivity to it. But there are rights. There are due process rights that are afforded people who don't agree with what we consider to be the conservative interpretation of a zoning rule or regulation. And that's the other part of the zoning ordinance, the Zoning Board of Adjustments, that hear those kind of issues. I need some relief, or I don't agree with the interpretation of the zoning official on a particular matter. There are ways that they can address that. Whereas you're really trying to look at the objectivity of particular setbacks is a great example. Setbacks and density issues, maximum or minimum and maximum square footage. Those are the kind of things that y'all are looking at when somebody's proposing a zoning amendment, for instance, and you have to decide whether or not an adjacent land use is appropriate for development next to whatever it may be. And you have to take into consideration. Now, what I don't want you to do is, and this is a common trap for zoning commissions, is to look exactly at the particular use being presented and think that that is the end-all be-it of what's going to be placed on that particular site. It's very easy to do, and a lot of times a proposed use will highlight issues like, oh, maybe there's not enough screening here, or maybe we'll, those kind of issues, but at the same time, you have to recognize and appreciate that just because they're proposing a particular use doesn't mean that by approving a land or a zoning amendment on that particular site, you're opening the door up for any use permitted in that particular zone. So if you put that kind of the bigger picture light and use both those to your advantage, because identifying whether a use, a particular proposed use is appropriate, is a great exercise into whether or not use is appropriate, if everybody understands the difference. Just something to keep in mind and something that happens more often than not. And it becomes unfortunate when you approve something that seems innocuous, seems like it's going to work because it's low-key, small square footage, low impact, high setback, but we've approved use by changing the zoning of a particular lot. And then 5 years down the road, they belly up, and then somebody puts in some monstrosity that's permitted in the zone, but not what you anticipated when you decided to change the zone. So just a cautionary tip there. If you're going to take a couple things out of it, that would be one of them. Just look at the big picture use rather than actual proposed use. I touched briefly on this earlier about zoning regulations take a long time to take effect. It's not a quick solution. It's a long-term solution. we create zones not to address immediate problems. And by doing so, you end up creating what looks like a congressional zone, a voting district at the end of the day. It doesn't make any sense. And it's really illegal. It's called spot zoning. But, you know, some things get caught in the gray area whenever you're changing zones around a transition boundary. But that is really unhealthy. The whole point of a zone is, and when you're recommending a zoning change, is to look at, okay, 30 years from now, after everything's developed, is this what makes sense in this area, this type of use? So that's, again, going back to the big picture. And then if there are things in there that are less desirable, mixed use in that particular zone, they redevelop over time. We'll all be gone by then, but you know, we do this for our grandchildren. So that as those things redevelop, those people can't go back and put the coal plant in the middle of the single-family residential zone. All they can put is an appropriate single-family house with the appropriate setbacks and all the other regulations that we have inherent in our zoning ordinance. And that's the point of those regulations. All right, this is where you come to the discretionary issues. And this is going to, I'm going to dumb down the legalese more for myself than y'all, just because it's a complicated area of the law. But zoning is an exercise of municipalities' police power. So there are things you can do that are, it doesn't mean PD. It means just you can go out and do certain things. We can take property. We can put in drainage. We can do water. We can do sewer. Those are all exercises of our police power, as they put it. But it has to be, whenever we do something in zoning, change a zone or create a zone or amend a regulation, it has to be rationally connected with the protection of the community's health, safety, and welfare. And that's the big picture thing again, is your test is a rational basis test in the courts. So when they're looking at whether or not the city council's decision to do something, a zoning amendment, is defensible, the first thing they're going to look at is, okay, they have a recommending body. What was their recommendation? And that's not necessarily a nail in the coffin because you are purely advisory, but it's a starting point for a clever plaintiff's lawyer. And they're going to look to see whether or not it was rationally connected to the general welfare or if you were just doing it to accommodate a development. And there's a huge gap between, you know, that single instance in which you're spot zoning and what you think's in the betterment of the community at large. So, again, the big it's just a good idea when you're going through this exercise to take a step back from whatever specifics are before you and decide whether or not this makes sense in the big picture. The discretion in the zoning decisions is true. Of course, there's a implied, I wouldn't call it implied, it's probably the wrong word, but there's great deference, we'll just say that, given to city council's decision to do something related to zoning, whether it be adopt a regulation or amend, because they're all technically amendments to the zoning ordinance. If you tweak the regulations in any capacity or change the boundaries in any capacity, it's considered a zoning amendment. The courts look at it and give great deference to that decision. There's almost a presumption that it's valid by doing so, but they look again at whether or not there's something rationally related to the community at large. So the courts look at the big picture, whether or not y'all decide to or not. And I say this only to emphasize that when you get caught in the weeds on a particular zoning amendment change, a lot of times you lose sight of that big picture. And it's good every now and then to reel yourselves back in and have a healthy discussion about that, because the court's ultimately going to look at that. And if they make an argument that, you know, city council's purely rubber stamping your advice and decision or recommendation on a particular matter, there's an argument to be made to void any action taken, and that can create inherently a takings claim. And these things, I mean, think about how long it takes to try a freaking case in this state. I mean, it's 2 years. So as this thing progresses through the courts, it may be 2.5 years since y'all made a decision on anything. 2.5 years is a long time to have to deal with a proposed development, any damage they allegedly suffered. So it's, again, these are all things I think are really healthy to have during your discussions. In reviewing a zoning decision, the question is not whether the decision was best for the community, but whether there's a rational connection between the decision and the community's health, safety, and welfare. I'll say this about these two. The spot zoning, you're doing something because of a particular development and leaning towards that starts to smell like that, and that's one of the big ticket items on trying to challenge one of these decisions by a wrong developer or somebody proposing something in your city. The other is a discrimination claim. You are all aware that we have certain protected classes in the United States, and that protected class seems to ever be growing, and the boundaries of that may be encompassing other things. Also, I think you're all aware that there are a lot of correlations between certain things that you may not consider to be discriminatory on its face, but the courts have looked at and said, I'll take income, for example. Income, how much money you make, is not a protected class. However, the courts have looked at and said, by taking certain action against certain income classes, you are inherently being discriminatory against certain minority groups. So there are, I think y'all just need to be aware that any time that you're looking at a zoning amendment decision, focus on the specifics, the setbacks, the density, the whether that makes sense in adjacent land uses. And a great example of this, and I'm dealing with this very issue with HUD in a city not to be named in Galveston County right now, where there is a claim by HUD, and they're, I don't know if they're going to turn it over to the Department of Justice or not, that we are being discriminatory against minorities because we did not want another low housing income project in a particular area. It's a medium density single family, and they wanted to change to single family, claiming there's a need for it. The city took the position that we have plenty of this already available. There's in our city, but we're in a gray area again. And depending on the administration, it's going to depend a lot on what kind of action. But HUD can be very aggressive about, especially single family and discrimination issues when it relates to low income or minority groups. So just be aware there are groups out there that look at that kind of stuff. So anytime you're talking about housing, it's important for you to look at the bigger picture, keep it square footage, density, the objective standards, and the what's in the best interest for the community at large. And you'll stay away from, nobody wants to be deposed in a lawsuit or be involved in one. Some general examples. Again, these are the objective standards that I had kind of mentioned, setbacks, height, driveway, cuts, tree preservation. I don't know if y'all participate in Tree City USA and those kind of things, but the zoning ordinances really give us a lot of opportunity to do some of these things down the road, and you may at some point decide to participate in some of these types of programs. I put this in, or Lauren put this in, you could add even more to this, about federal regulations. We're all preempted from doing things that violate federal law. There's certain discretion given to churches, for instance, and where they can locate and how we address. I don't know if y'all have dealt with a church. Is a church something that's permitted by zone, or is it something that goes through the specific use permit process?
Church can be in any district.
Any district, yes. By zone. So it's not a problem for y'all. Don't worry about it. Moving on. The telecommunications, that's probably the most ripe thing right now, is is cell phone nodes. And I don't know if you've had any developers in your city that have wanted to place these nodes in different ways, and have y'all adopted an ordinance?
We
have. Kind of. Okay, good. So you're already ahead of the game. We're fighting with Verizon and Stafford right now on that ordinance, so stay tuned. We'll see what the feds are going to let us get away with. But point being is there are certain things that we're going to be preempted from saying, no, you can't do it, but you're going to have to rely on your staff to tell you when there's a problem there. Before we go into the conflicts, public information, open meetings, does anybody have any specific questions about either your platting commission hat or your zoning commission hat?
How does COPD's affect spotting? The spot, you're talking about a spot effort, I think is what you called it. And when you
what acronym you're using for COPD?
Conditional operate. It was
CUP.
CUP.
Okay, so yes, it's like a PID. Y'all just call them.
No, that's a disease.
Conditional use permit.
Yes.
So instead of specific use permit, you call them conditional use permits.
Yeah, yes. Or a specific zone.
Well, really, the whole point of a conditional use permit is just that. It's this. I think the legislative group, council, and y'all is recommending those regulations are what is permitted in a particular zone. Recognizes, and I'll use church, even though you allow churches, but it's very common for cities to require churches, schools, neighborhood markets through this conditional use permit process in a zone. So we recognize that it's compatible with houses. We just want to ensure that if you're going to put one right in the middle of these houses, that we have the ability to look at the specific site, what you're specifically proposing, and ensure that we're protecting. It usually has to do with setbacks, screening, things like that, noise, lighting. So that gives you another layer of, okay, not only do you have to adhere to the rules for that district, but you're going to have to add these other things in order to satisfy the concerns of the residences or our concerns related to the things like the aforementioned stuff, the traffic, noise, lighting, things like that. So it's one of the few exceptions where you actually get to add rules. But it's set up so you can add conditions, and hence the word conditional use permit. So we're going to give you a permit to move forward with use. And this isn't a building permit. This is just you're permitted to use this property for this purpose with these conditions. that we think are appropriate, you know, in light of this, what you're proposing to develop. I find that to be different than what I call a zoning amendment, a change, where if somebody's saying, I want you to change this block of stuff to commercial because we would like to put in warehouse district right here. Well, then you look at what's going on with the adjacent property owners, and you're really not adding rules. You're saying, okay, the bigger picture, do the rules in the commercial zone make sense for here, regardless of what's developed, and then you make a recommendation based on that. Do you kind of get the difference, the distinction? Okay. Anybody else? All right. Everybody's favorite topic, conflicts of interest. Has anybody had to file a Chapter 171 conflict of interest affidavit?
I think so.
Do you remember what it was for?
For ownership of a case that was coming before the commission, if I owned more than some percentage, I think.
Okay. So you owned a case?
Well, is that the form I fill out? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you mean by case?
Well, no. I mean, if I have a plat that's on the agenda.
Oh, are you a developer?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yes. Yeah. And that's yes. Okay. So, you own 10% more of that business?
Right.
Or you receive 10% of your income from that business?
Right.
There's
several blanks on there that I have to put check marks on.
Yes. And we try to make it as simple as possible. But it really boils down to two things. One is, if you receive 10% or more of your income, whether you own it or you just work there, from whatever entity seeking to do business before council and through you as a recommending body, then you have to recuse yourself.
That's right.
So, and we live in what's called an affirmative vote state. Texas is one of, I think, 10 that basically the law recognizes that if you don't vote, this has the same legal effect as a no vote. If you didn't file out a conflict of interest statement and voted or sat there or just said, I abstain without filing the actual affidavit, the law looks at it and says you voted no. So I mean, it can change where the vote goes. Now, as a purely advisory group, it's not going to change ultimately what council does, but I think you should be aware of the fact that by not looking at that and taking the necessary steps, that you can affect the overall vote and whether or not you had a positive or a negative referral.
And like in my instance, I fill out the form typically before the meeting, and then I'll tell our chairman that, hey, I'm abstaining from this item, you know, before the meeting.
Perfect.
And then I walk out.
So well, you even walk out.
I do. I leave the building.
Belt and suspenders.
Yeah.
That's fine. That is a, you know, I had to tell a council member in Alvin one time, who was about twice my size and weight, that he needed to leave the room because he didn't want to sign a piece of paper. But it is a way, if you forget, or for whatever reason the secretary doesn't have one available and a conflict arises, you can recuse yourself from the room. It has the same legal effect as you being absent. Doesn't affect yay or nay either way. So it's a backup. There's your suspenders. The other is real property. $2,500 in real property. This is where it gets confusing, though, is, you know, what's the test? And that's, how do I know if my real property is being affected? Oh, I went too far. Sorry about that. The real property, if you read, kind of, both of them are very similar, and that is, it has a special economic effect on you that's different and distinguishable from the general public. And the general public doesn't have to mean everybody in the city. If the city wants to do something on your street, or there's a replat, you know, adjacent to your piece of property, that you're going to get a new road out of it incidentally, it doesn't create a special, unique economic effect on you individually different from anybody else on your street. So if you just keep that in mind, and it doesn't have to be everybody, just use your best judgment. And if you're looking at a plat that has some positive incidental benefit to you individually in your home or even property that you own, it may not necessarily create a conflict. You have to look and see, well, is everybody getting the same benefit I am? If they are, fine. The extreme, you know, the coal mine and the single family district example in this arena is if the city was looking to acquire property. You know, if they were looking to exercise eminent domain and take your property or buy some of your property, then obviously you're going to have a special economic benefit different in kind from the public. Bless you.
Thank you.
Is everybody clear on conflicts?
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Because this has come up before.
Sure.
If you have a zoning on your neighboring property, and it's a neighboring property of a planning commissioner, so he's within the 200-foot notification
yes.
zone, is that considered a conflict?
No.
Okay.
Oh. It's not. Just because you receive 200-foot notice does not create a conflict. Again, it has to have a special economic benefit to your property. If you are asking that your property be rezoned, you're receiving a special economic benefit. There's a conflict, but no, just receiving the 200 foot. Have you been told differently?
No, they
asked me because it was. He's talking about a case. Oh, well, hypothetically, we're talking about a case that I could have been involved.
Hypothetically, we're talking about you.
Yeah. And anyway.
So you have something on the agenda tonight, hypothetically?
No, but it was within 200 feet. And so Lauren said, probably good if I just went out and set an audience and did not vote on it.
That's an ultra-conservative approach. You have to make that decision.
Well, I didn't have a problem.
I mean, what's the risk? That's what we, I mean, y'all want to know what's the risk of this stuff happening when it comes to reason? I think I told you early on, is a clever plaintiff's lawyer is going to look at all the due process. Where did this process start? Starts at the staff level. You're the first actual governmental entity that hears what's being proposed. So if you want to eliminate the risk, fine. But, I mean, for instance, I'll take a small town. Here's an exaggerated example. A small town, Orchard, has a population of 300. It's in Fort Bend County. Everybody in that city lives within 200 feet. I mean, is everybody conflicted out? No. You just have to use your best judgment. If you are right next to the property and whatever they're proposing is going to increase your value, probably different in kind than your neighbor even further one down, then probably creates a conflict. If you're on the edge of that and any benefit you receive is incidental to what's going to happen in the area, it's not a conflict. Don't you love the law? I know. Yeah. It's all gray and wishy-washy. But I don't know if that helps or made it worse.
What if it's negative?
What do you mean?
Yeah. What if it affects me negatively?
I don't think I still think it creates a special economic effect.
Well, let's say they decide they're going to put a brothel in next to me, and I. Well, that's about as hypothetical as I can.
Yeah,
get.
A use next to you isn't going to create necessarily a.
But it would make devaluation my go down.
And everybody else around you too, allegedly. Just throw allegedly after all that stuff, because we don't know necessarily that a brothel is going to decrease property value. I'm just being a lawyer. But no, I would say you're going to have to if anybody in this board is concerned or commission is concerned about that, ask Lauren. And he'll look at your specific situation, and it becomes a risk assessment. But not inherently getting 200-foot notice is not going to create a conflict necessarily. Any other questions related to that? Did I just make your job worse? I think I did.
Yeah.
You're welcome. See, it's easy to do this and then run away to a different town and then let Lauren deal with all the mess I create. So, okay, open meetings. I think everybody in here is aware that you're subject to the Texas Open Meetings Act. Does everybody understand what that means? Posted 72 hours. You can only talk about things that are on the agenda. It is still Tomball, even though you're growing. You know, going down to the coffee house with a group of y'all, which usually doesn't happen at the P&Z level, to talk about an issue that's coming up on the next agenda, if that gets out, is a violation. This is another one of those plaintiff's lawyers love to grab onto an open meetings violation because it makes all action after the violation voidable. Now, granted, you're purely advisory, but still, it creates the impression of impropriety, which a lot of times for courts, because we have courts that tend to lean a little more less local protection and more property owner interest nowadays. So bad facts create bad law. And governments have been afforded a lot of immunity defenses and a lot of protections over the years that are slowly being eroded. So again, use your best discretion and try to avoid any discussion on topics, even controversial as they may be, until you get in an open forum. If we heard it, that's the walking quorum. And did y'all take the Attorney General's 1 hour training video? Everybody did. Do they keep stuff on record with you? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have all their stuff, their training. Are you also the designated records keeper?
Formerly Doris Spear, our city secretary.
Okay, so somebody's doing the training on their behalf?
Yes.
So y'all don't have to take the Public Information Act stuff? Mm-hmm. Has anybody done it? Okay. Emails is probably where you get yourself in your biggest problem. Is just be aware that all emails related to anything city business are discoverable, and we will have to go through your public affairs to filter out what is public and what is not. It can be quite embarrassing, and I do it at least once a month with somebody's cell phone, usually a cell phone, because they'll use their personal cell phone, interactive with city business. Do y'all have city, official city emails? Okay. You can send, if you receive an email that you're concerned may be considered public information, regardless of where it came from, if you want to forward it to whomever, I don't know if the appropriate person.
Sure.
And then you can delete it. Point being, you just have to keep a copy of it versus me going through your cell phone, which can be interesting. I've seen some interesting things. Talked about that. So just really emails is the biggest thing. I want to give you all at least a 10-minute break. Does anybody have any questions or concerns about this? And I know the conflict of interest thing wasn't a slam dunk answer, but I guarantee you that.
Well, I trust him.
It would be, if he's looking at it and has any concerns and says, you know, just to be safe, it's better if you leave and it's not going to affect the overall recommendation, it's probably a good idea to err on the conservative side when it comes to that stuff. So.
I have a question that I think they may want to know about. Can you maybe get into the details of a walking quorum? Because that's a little bit.
Sure, and this is you're not going to like this, but we deal with these suits a lot. It's a made-up thing that by our Texas Attorney General's office. But essentially takes the position that if two of y'all get together and talk about an issue and then one of those two people goes on and talks it to the next person, it's almost like the old grapevine in elementary school where you just kind of pass the message down the road. If a quorum of the entity hears the opinions of other people, then it can constitute what's called a walking quorum, where you have intentionally circumvented the Texas Open Meetings Act and can be considered a violation of the act. That is it. It's in deliberation. I mean, to oversimplify it, just means expressing your opinion. And if you're out and you hear some information or statements made of fact about, oh, well, they're building a new HEB, and I know you'll have a nice HEB, but let's just use that as an example. They're building a new HEB down the road, and that's just a matter of fact. You're not saying, I don't like that HEB. I don't think we should even consider a zoning amendment right there. That needs to be single family. That's when you cross a line into what's called a deliberation.
This is another hypothetical. Let's just say everybody in P&Z calls me before a case comes. Let's just say they all call me individually the day of the hearing. And I answer their questions. They could be different questions. They could be the same questions.
They got rid of the staff briefing exception. I mean, you're supposed to brief counsel in that manner, but the distribution of information has been somewhat accepted in that area. I don't know a city in Texas that doesn't give out packet information prior to the meeting. So as long as you're simply answering matters of fact and then we'll discuss it tonight at the meeting, I'm okay with that.
I've got one more question.
Sure.
We were talking about recommendations. Our job is to make recommendations to the city council.
Correct.
Okay. Craig, I thought when I've been there, you just tell them how we vote. You don't say what we say. Is that correct?
Well, that is your recommendation.
That's it. That's all it is.
Yes. I mean, you could, by formal motion, add to it if you wanted to. But essentially, your recommendation is that a majority of y'all thought that you were in favor of it as presented.
And that's all a recommendation is?
That's all it can be.
Okay.
I mean, it could be more. I don't know. It, as a matter of practice, have they ever conditioned something? Mm-hmm. We're okay with this approval so long as they address this issue or...
Yeah, like with conditional use permits, with low conditions.
Very similar.
We carry those forward. But
COPs?
COPs. but what we do, what I do with city council is I bring forward staff's recommendation because that never changes from the beginning to end.
Sure.
And then I bring forward Planning and Zoning Commission's recommendation as well. And then, so I bring, if we differ, but I'll bring.
If we differ.
If
okay.
we differ. But I'll tell them that.
Yeah, I would imagine though, if there was a particular issue in which y'all said, we're fine with this, provided, however, we'd like y'all to really consider this, you know, we have some concerns about this. They could add it as part of your staff, your comments.
Okay.
Or the background information related to that particular item, if it came up. Anybody have anything else?
Just one comment.
Yes, sir.
The plat process that we go through, I've been here 4 years maybe. I've never seen us do anything but rubber stamp them. Now, what would constitute something that we would really
go after? Yeah, I'll give you an extreme example.
Okay.
Is in the city of Rosenberg, when they really started to grow, they proposed a mixed-use It was a Walmart and two other big box. It was a pretty significant development on a secondary street with very limited access and huge traffic problems. So they required them to produce an additional traffic study so that we could justify requiring them to put in certain turn lanes and things like that. So it's a recognition of something that is so egregious that creates a circumstance that becomes a health, safety, welfare problem, usually dealing with emergency services, and that's where the traffic stuff came in. But it was so egregious that we had to push the envelope to get them to comply with an additional ingress, egress points and dedicated turn lanes to alleviate some of the problems. There was a school right down the street, so there was a couple play issues at Factor. But
you didn't deny it.
No, we did it with the understanding that, and there are developers who can push that issue and say, no, we're meeting all the rules and regulations that you require us to do. We're not required to make improvements to your public right-of-way. And the problem is take a thoroughfare, for instance, take your main drag through town. If you came in and a huge new development wanted to put itself down the road a little bit and you thought it necessitated an additional lane, you said, we're not going to allow you to put it in unless you put in an additional lane of traffic. The courts have said, no, you can't do that. You can only attribute the over-improvement to the development itself. Anything additional becomes part of the public sector and the takings. Does that make sense? I mean, we can only make them do what the additional burden that they place on site. And you get into a kind of gray area when you start pushing that envelope. So really, I think it's one of those deals where at the staff level, if they envision something like that coming up, that needs to be addressed, they'll get in touch with Lauren and we'll hopefully come up with a solution with the developer. And that's usually how those things play out, because it's in both parties' best interest to have appropriate ingress, egress, especially with retail. So
right.
that's the one that comes to mind. And it would have been overburdensome and taxing at that point, would have created a huge fire hazard.
Thank you.
All right, Madam Chair, that's all I have.
Thank you very much. We do appreciate it.
Anytime.
Thank you for coming. All right. Is there a motion to approve adjournment?
Motion to approve adjournment.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. Is there a second?
A second.
Thank you, Commissioner Dunnigan. Please enter your vote now.
Motion carries unanimously.
All right. And the meeting is now adjourned, and the time is 5:54. All right. See you back in 6 minutes. 5 minutes. 1 minute till.
Great.
Thank y'all. Hot seat. Yeah. So is Lauren here tonight? No. Our gentleman is going to be here.
I don't have any. Can I send you a...
Does it administrate?
Yeah. Sounds good. It's in there.
Have a good night. Thanks for coming.
How are you doing?
That's awesome.
You okay? You okay? You sound hoarse.
Pardon?
You sound hoarse. Oh, yeah. I got a great grandkid now. They're fun.
You enjoyed your grandkid?
Yes. Yep. Some basic comments on that, but I like the
paper. He's a very bright man. Very bright man.
Hey, thanks for coming.
Hopefully, you got at least one or two things, man.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Haven't had a chance.
How you been?
Hi, I'm Barbara. It's nice to meet you.
David and Lauren's just top notch.
Good. Yep.
You know, he and I are very close. We're friends and partners in this
partnership. He's been tremendous for us.
Yep.
Is he in the
other
cities as
well? He literally just told me, he was like, I'll talk to us.
Yeah, we're all juggling something different tonight. It's always a holiday. You know, it starts with kind of everything Thanksgiving and people start shifting stuff around.
Yep.
So, but
the acreage for the tax benefits is not able.
Yeah, he's represents
a lot.
Two out of ten.
Yes.
Oh, cool. So they reject it.
Handles most of our eminent domain work. He and I do. He and I do all.
I think they will really work on things.
Minor litigation stuff like nuisance abatements, substandard structures, appeals from these kind of things. We have a litigation department that does a bigger case. In fact, I was in court this afternoon for it.
And you guys, do you exclusively represent cities?
Yeah. I've never had a court, but it's pretty rewarding. It can be.
Oh, sure. Oh, that's great stuff.
It's fun. 90% of the time we're on the right side of things. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun coming out here.
And you live in downtown, or?
Yeah, I live in the first floor. I don't know where that is. Houston Avenue and Washington Avenue.
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect there.
Live in old 1910 Queen Anne Victoria.
Get out.
Which one? Which one?
Which one what?
Which old Queen Anne Victoria?
My address is 1520 Spring Street, northeast corner. It's on the hike and bike, Spring and Johnson.
Yeah.
It's an orange house if you ever pass by. Right now we got three little kittens on the front porch. One of our inherited strays beside our kittens in our front yard. So I'm trying to keep my dogs from eating. No, I moved there about 10 years ago when it was still pretty rough. And there it's changed significantly. But my bride, my wife, is from the third floor. She won't let me leave the loop.
Are you big in architecture?
What's that?
Are you big in architecture?
I worked at downtown police station for 30 years.
Hey, you're right down the road.
Yeah, that's right there.
Cool. You have an excellent view of the fireworks every 4th of July.
I have some front porch here watching.
Yeah.
Until they build something, you know, because they're building those 4-story.
When I work downtown, that's where I work.
That's great.
Where I watch
the great spot. You're right. It is. So
that's cool. I didn't know you were three in law enforcement.
Oh, yeah. I'm retired this year. Last year, okay. Like a year ago. Next week from the East Police Department. First 3 years.
Nice. Yeah. What did you do? Probably a bunch of different roles.
Over the years, I retired as a lieutenant out of robbery division, which was my favorite job.
Robbery?
Yeah. And I spent 19 years working in 61 region.
You're disposing of change in a zone.
Oh, wow.
And so it was always my favorite place to go.
Yeah.
And the history of Houston is phenomenal, especially the first ward.
Yeah. Wait, only at City of Houston, or
we have other?
Only City of Houston.
Oh, wow. That's pretty cool. But did you go through the Houston Academy?
Additional changes within the regulations in the zone.
Wow.
21 years old when I joined.
Okay.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't see that too much anymore.
I mean, it's a
good job. I mean, I liked everything about it.
Yeah.
You know, some things I didn't take care of, but it was a great job. We had a lot of fun. Got to meet a lot of great people.
Yeah. And
if I went to somebody's house, it was like his. And they'd show me all the little things that.
Yeah, and that's like, all that. That's that area that's like right there off of Washington. That's neat.
His house probably does not have a garage because they were built before garages.
Yeah. My wife and I, when we first got married, we moved to Houston and lived on Allen Parkway in Allen House Apartments right there. And so that was when Tropical Storm Allison came in.
Oh, you count the entire
so,
yeah.
Well, you can.
We were looking at houses. So I was working at this
year.
We were looking at houses that were on Gray Street. I think it was right behind us, or West Gray. And so we were looking at a house there, and it was like a two-bedroom, two-bath, maybe 1,400 square feet. It might have been 1,200 square feet. No garage. Although it did have like a makeshift thing for that.
Yeah,
125,000. And my wife is like, Will, we can get a brand new trailer for $125. I'm going, yeah, but honey, it's not a downtown. This is kind of, and this was right when the Heights was just getting started.
Big back here.
And, anyway, so we ended up passing on that.
Regrets.
Thanks, man.
A lot of people did. My daughter lives in an apartment off Birdsall, man. Which 30 years ago, I would have told him no. But, you know, go down to town.
There's a lot of
redevelopment.
kitchen.
A lot of areas. I mean, like going down 45, 60
areas. Sometimes.
No one's redeveloped whatsoever, other than the mall down there.
It's common.
That's what I'm thinking, because it's so close and the lots are so near. In fact, right around
where I was. The problem with that is most of those folks own their lots. So when you're dealing with, you're not dealing with somebody that has bought up lots over the years and rented out the property. You're dealing with homeowners that's a lot more expensive to go in there and redevelop. When they were doing the Rice Military District, right there at the border in the Memorial Park.
That's what I need.
You don't want 4 hours a week.
You got to start there. And there were three stories.
Raise the red flag.
This lady's out there ringing the windows. How many times have you been on
the
to buy your lot today? She goes, four times today.
Yeah.
I'm selling.
That's from the Great Oak School.
Where's this stuff?
That's how it was, Rice Military.
I remember looking in Rice Military because we were trying to, we were going to buy a lot of the house.
No, this is,
just, everything was in transition at the same time, right? So this was 98. So Rice Military, everything was
okay.
They're good. How's everything at Odyssey?
We got to get started. We're late.
Yeah, it's cold today for sure. It's supposed to be colder tomorrow.
Christmas ornaments got me.
Was it good? Yeah, good seeing you. Yep, it's not on yet.
I hate these damn computers.
Okay, now you guys can walk in. New meeting, new roll call.